called Sakinaka. Among Sakinaka's acres of sheds were metal melting and plastic shredding machines owned by men in starched kurtas, white kurtas, to announce the owner's distance from the filth of their trade. Some of the workers at the plants were black-faced from carbon dust and surely black-lunged from breathing iron shavings. A few weeks ago, Abdul had seen a boy's hand cut clean off when he was putting plastic into one of the shredders. The boy's eyes had filled with tears, but he hadn't screamed. Instead, he'd stood there with his blood-spurting stump, his ability to earn a living ended, and started apologizing to the owner of the plant.
"Saab, I'm sorry,"
he'd said to the man in white.
"I won't cause you any problems by reporting this. You will have no trouble from me."
For all Mirchi's talk of progress, India still made a person know his place, and wishing things different struck Abdul as a childish pastime, like trying to write your name in a bowl of melted kulfi. He had been working as hard as he could in the stigmatized occupation he'd been born to, and it was no longer a profitless position. He intended to return home with both hands and a pocketful of money. His mental estimates of the weight of his goods had been roughly correct. Peak season recyclables, linked to a flourishing global market, had bestowed on his family an income few residents of Annawadi had ever known. He had made a profit of 500 rupees, or $11 a day, enough to jumpstart the plan that inspired his mother's morning curses, and that even the little Husseins knew to keep close. With this take, added to savings from the previous year, his parents would now make their first deposit on a 1,200-square-foot plot of land in a quiet community in Vasai, just outside the city, where Muslim recyclers predominated. If life and global markets kept going their way, they would soon be landowners, not squatters, in a place where Abdul was pretty sure no one would call him garbage. Chapter 2. Asha. Rahul's mother, Asha, took note in that winter of hope. The slumlord of Annawadi had gone batty and pious. Although Robert Perez beat his second wife, he let her live. He erected a Christian shrine outside his hut, then a second shrine to a Hindu goddess. Before these altars every Saturday, he clasped his meaty hands in prayer and atoned for all past crimes by giving tea and bread to hungry children. Weekdays, the attractions of the underworld paling, he passed the hours in slack communion with 9 horses he stabled in the slum, 2 of which he painted with stripes to look like zebras. Robert rented the fake zebras, along with a cart, to the birthday parties of middle-class children, a turn to honest work he thought the judging gods might factor in. In this reformation, 39-year-old Asha Wagekar perceived an opportunity. Robert had lost his taste for power just as she was discovering her own. Let others thread the marigolds. Let others sort the trash. For the overcity people who wished to exploit Annawadi and the undercity people who wished to survive it, she wanted to be the woman to see. Slumlord was an unofficial position, but residents knew who held it, the person chosen by local politicians and police officers to run the settlement according to the authorities' interests. Even in a rapidly modernizing India, female slumlords were relative rarities, and those women who managed to secure such power typically had inherited land claims or were stand-ins for powerful husbands. Asha had no claims. Her husband was an alcoholic, an itinerant construction worker, a man thoroughgoing only in his lack of ambition. As she'd raised their 3 children, who were now teenagers, few neighbors thought of her as anyone's wife. She was simply Asha, a woman on her own. Had the situation been otherwise, she might not have come to know her own brain. Robert's chief contribution to Annawadi history had been to bring Asha and the other Maharashtrians to the slum as part of a Shiv Sena effort to expand its voting bloc at the airport. A public water connection was secured as an enticement, and by 2002, the Maharashtrians had disempowered the Tamil laborers who had first cleared the land. But a majority is a hard thing to maintain in a slum where almost no one has permanent work. People came and went, selling or renting their huts in a thriving underground trade, and by early 2008, the North Indian migrants against whom Shiv Sena campaigned had become a plurality. What was clear to Asha was also clear to the corporator of Ward 76, the elected official of the precinct in which Anawadi sat. Robert now belonged to his zebras. He'd lost interest in Shiv Sena and the slum. The corporator, Subhash Savant, was a man of pancake makeup, hair dye, aviator sunglasses, and perspicacity. While the obvious choice to succeed Robert as slumlord would have been a well-spoken Shiv Sena activist named Avinash, Avinash was too distracted to serve the corporator's interests. He was fixing hotel septic systems day and night to afford private schooling for his son. Asha, on the other hand, had time. Her temp work, teaching kindergartners at a large municipal school for modest pay, was a sinecure the corporator had helped her obtain, overlooking the fact that her formal schooling had stopped at seventh grade. In return, she spent a good deal of class time on her cell phone, conducting Shiv Sena business. She could deliver her neighbors to the polls. She could mobilize 100 women for a last-minute protest march. The corporator thought she could do more. He asked her to handle a petty Anawadi problem, and then another somewhat less petty, and yet another not petty at all, at which point he gave her a bouquet of flowers and his fat wife started giving her the fisheye. Asha took these things to be signs of an imminent triumph. 8 years after arriving in Anawadi and investing her hopes for economic betterment in political work, she had an influential patron. In time, she imagined, even the men of Anawadi would have to admit she was becoming the most powerful person in this stinking place. Many of the men had preyed on her early on. Essaying her large breasts and her small drunken husband, they had suggested diversions that might allay her children's poverty. The menacing Robert had made his own blunt proposal one evening as she was filling a pot of water at the tap. Asha had set down the pot and replied coolly,
"Whatever you want. Tell me, bastard. Shall I strip naked and dance for you now?"
No other woman, then or since, had spoken to the slumlord that way. Asha had developed her sharp tongue as a child, working the fields of an impoverished village in northeastern Maharashtra. Pointed expression had been a useful defense when laboring among lecherous men. Discretion and subtlety, qualities useful in controlling a slum, were things she had learned since coming to the city. She had by now seen past the obvious truth, that Mumbai was a hive of hope and ambition, to a profitable corollary. Mumbai was a place of festering grievance and ambient envy. Was there a soul in this enriching, unequal city who didn't blame his dissatisfaction on someone else? Wealthy citizens accused the slum dwellers of making the city filthy and unlivable, even as an oversupply of human capital kept the wages of their maids and chauffeurs low. Slum dwellers complained about the obstacles the rich and powerful erected to prevent them from sharing a new profit. Everyone, everywhere, complained about their neighbors. But in the 21st century city, fewer people joined up to take their disputes to the streets. As group identities based on caste, ethnicity, and religion gradually attenuated, anger and hope were being privatized like so much else in Mumbai. This development increased the demand for canny mediators, human shock absorbers for the colliding, narrowly construed interests of one of the world's largest cities. Over time, of course, many shock absorbers lost their spring. But who is to say that a woman, a relative novelty, wouldn't prove to have a longer life? Asha had a gift for solving the problems of her neighbors. Now that she had the corporator's ear, she could fix more such problems, on commission. And when she had real control over the slum, she could create problems in order to fix them, a profitable sequence she'd learned by studying the corporator. Guilt of the sort that had overcome Robert was an impediment to effective work in the city's back channels, and Asha considered it a luxury emotion.
"Corruption. It's all corruption,"
she told her children, fluttering her hands like two birds taking flight. As Asha arrived home from her teaching job one afternoon, her step didn't quicken when she saw supplicants lined up against the wall of her hut. From the corporator, she had learned the psychological advantage of making people wait and stew. With barely a nod to her visitors, she stepped behind a lacy curtain at the back of her hut and unraveled the deep red sari she'd worn to work. Now that she was older, her eyes drew more attention than her breasts. She could weaponize them in an instant, and boys caught gaping at her magnificent 19-year-old daughter, Manju, would reel backward as if they'd been struck. When Asha thought about money, her eyes narrowed. She thought about money most of the time. Anuwadians called her Squint behind her back. But the real distinction of her eyes was their brightness. Most eyes dulled with age and disappointment. Hers looked far more radiant now than they did in the photograph she possessed of her youth. A tall, stooped, emaciated farm girl with sun-darkened skin, freshly embarked on a disastrous marriage. When Asha looked at that photo, she laughed. She emerged from behind the curtain in a shapeless house dress, another strategy picked up from the corporator. He often presided over his lavender-walled, lavender-furnished living room in an undershirt, legs barely covered by his lungi, while his petitioners flop-sweated in polyester suits. He might as well have said it aloud. "Your concerns are so unimportant to me that I haven't bothered to dress." Settling on the floor, Asha accepted the cup of tea brought by Manju and nodded for the first of her neighbors to speak. An old woman with a creased, beautiful face and matted coils of silver hair, she hadn't arrived with a problem. She was weeping in gratitude, because on this date, 3 years earlier, Asha had helped her secure a temp job with the city government, extricating trash from clogged sewers for 90 rupees a day. Before Asha had learned better, she had performed many such kindnesses for free. From her pay, the older woman had bought Asha a cheap green sari. Asha didn't care for the color. Still, it was good for the other visitors to hear the old woman's blessings, see the way she pressed her forehead to Asha's bare feet. Another weeper spoke next, an overweight exotic dancer who had lost her job in a bar and was now getting by as the concubine of a married policeman. She had to service the officer in the hut she shared with her mother and her children, which was prompting family hysterics.
"He says he's going to stop coming because of the drama. Then what will we eat?"
Asha clucked. A morals campaign had driven most of the sex trade out of the airport area, and Anuwadi's outline women, as they were known, now had three bad options for satisfying their clients. In their family huts, behind a line of trucks parked nightly outside of Anuwadi, or in the gaudy one-room brothel. Briskly, Asha issued her advice. "Explain more clearly to your family the long-term advantages of the liaison."
"Maybe the officer doesn't give you too much now, but later he might fix your house, so tell them to stay quiet and wait and see."
As she spoke, she ran her fingertips over her new orange ceramic floor tiles. 8 years back, when Anuwadi was a flimsy encampment, her three children had jumped truck beds to steal the wood and aluminum scrap from which the family had hammered up a shack. Now the hut had plaster walls, a ceiling fan, a wooden shrine with an electric candle, and a high-status, if non-functioning, refrigerator. The place was narrow and cramped, though. That had been the trade-off. To finance the improvements that might persuade her neighbors of her rising status, she'd rented bits of her living space to some of the continual stream of newcomers to Mumbai. Migrant tenants were holed up in a side room, a back room, and on the roof. Although Shiv Sena was hostile to such migrants, Asha had always been more practical than ideological, and considered no financial opportunity too small.
"Why do you care if other people call us misers?" she asked her children.
As they said in her village, drops of rain fill the lake.
"Be quick, I have people waiting," Asha said into her cell phone.
It was her younger sister, of whom she was jealous. Her sister's husband was a hard-working chauffeur, and their hut in a nearby slum had a stereo system and four fluffy white dogs, just for fun. Asha's consolation was that her sister's daughter was plain and slow and nothing like Manju, the only college-going girl in Anawadi, who was now kneading bread dough for dinner and pretending she wasn't eavesdropping on her mother's conversations. Asha's sister had been trying to enter the fixing business and saw an opening in the fact that a Hindu girl in her slum had run off with a Muslim boy. Asha stepped outside her house and lowered her voice.
"The main thing," she advised her sister, "is that you take money from the family of the girl, but never say it's you who is asking for money. Tell them the police are asking for it. I have to go."
An old friend, Raja Kamble, stiffened when Asha came back in, for his turn to speak had come. Asha and Mr. Kamble had come to Anawadi at the same time. Their children had grown up together. Now, Mr. Kamble was painful to look at, knee knobs and eye sockets mainly. He was counting on Asha to save his life. Mr. Kamble had grown up even poorer than Asha, abandoned infant, dweller on pavement, doer of hopeless jobs, among them trudging office to office, trying to sell scented cloths to slip into the earpieces of telephones on the tiniest of commissions.
"A perfumed phone cloth, Saab, to hide the hot season stink."
In his 30s, though, he'd had a bolt of fortune. While he was working at a train station food kiosk, a regular customer, a maintenance worker for the city government, had come to like and pity him. In short order, the man offered Mr. Kamble his own surname, a bride, and the grail of every poor person in Mumbai, a permanent job like his own. That job had been to clean public toilets and falsify the timesheets of his benefactor and other sanitation workers so that they could take other jobs while collecting their municipal pay. Mr. Kamble felt honored by this responsibility. He and his wife had 3 children, bricked the walls of their hut, and on one wall installed a cage for 2 pet pigeons. In his pavement-dwelling years, he developed a fondness for birds. Mr. Kamble had been one of Anawadi's great successes, a man deemed worthy of titles like G or Mr. until the day he collapsed while cleaning a shitter. His heart was bad. The sanitation department laid him off, saying that if he got a new heart valve and a doctor's clearance, he could return. Mumbai's public hospitals were supposed to do such operations for next to nothing, but the hospital surgeons wanted under-the-table money. 60,000 rupees, said the surgeon at Sion Hospital. The doctor at Cooper Hospital wanted more. For every 2 people in Anawadi inching up, there was 1 in a catastrophic plunge. But Mr. Kamble still had hope. For the last 2 months, he'd been dragging his betrayal of a body out on the streets, asking politicians, charities, and corporations to donate to his heart valve fund. The corporator had pledged 300 rupees. An executive at a paint factory had pledged 1,000. After hundreds of pleas, he was still 40,000 rupees short. Now he clenched a smile at Asha, 10 square yellow teeth that appeared huge in his wasted face.
"I don't want a handout," he said. "I want to fix my heart so I can keep working and see my children married. So could you fix one of the government loans for me?"
He had learned that Asha was a minor player in a scam involving one of the many anti-poverty schemes the central government in New Delhi had enacted in order to bring more citizens into its growth story. The government was lending money at subsidized rates to help poor entrepreneurs start employment-generating businesses. These new companies could be fictions, though. A slum dweller would request a loan for an imaginary business. A local government official would certify how many jobs it would bring to a needy community, and an executive of the state-owned Dana Bank would approve it. Then the official and the bank manager would take a hunk of the loan money. Asha, having befriended the bank manager, was helping him select the Anawadians who would get loans, for her own cut of the loan money, she hoped. Mr. Kamble had decided his imaginary business would be a food stall like the one where he'd been working when his luck changed. If he got a loan of 50,000 rupees, and from that paid 5,000 each to Asha, the bank manager, and the government official, he would be only 5,000 rupees short of the heart valve and could go to a loan shark for the rest.
"You can see my situation, Asha," he said. "No work, no income, until I have the operation. And if I don't have the operation, you understand."
She looked him over and made the ch-ch sound she often made when she was thinking.
"Yes, I can see you are in a bad state," she said after a minute. "What you should do, I think, is go to the temple. No, go to my godman, Gajanan Maharaj, and pray."
He looked stunned.
"Pray?" "Yes. You should pray for what you want every day. Alone, good health, pray to this godman. Keep hope. Tell him to help you, and you might get it."
Asha's daughter Manju inhaled sharply. Growing up, she had sometimes wished that the gentle Mr. Kumble had been her father. And she knew, as Mr. Kumble did, that when Asha said go to the temple and the godman, it meant to come back with a better financial proposal.
"But we are friends. You have known me, so I thought."
Mr. Kumble sounded as if he'd swallowed sand.
"Fixing a loan is not a simple thing. It is because we are friends that I want the gods to help you. So you live a long, good life."
As Mr. Kumble limped away, Asha felt confident that he'd come back to her before he would go to any temple. A dying man should pay a lot to live. Lately, Asha had been shirking the temple herself. She considered herself a religious woman, but in recent weeks she'd noticed that she got what she wanted from the gods regardless of whether she prayed or fasted. For some time, she'd been meaning to pray for the downfall of a neighbor woman who said rude things about the nature of Asha's relationship to the corporator. But before Asha had gotten around to it, the woman's husband fell ill, her elder son got hit by a car, and her younger son fell off a motorcycle. Asha concluded from this and other evidence that she had fallen into a cosmic groove of fortune, perhaps the very groove that Mr. Kumble had recently vacated. Across the room, her daughter was throwing a tantrum. The quiet kind, the only kind Manju ever threw. She was flinging the chopped onions into the frying pan with such force that some bounced out and onto the floor. Asha raised an eyebrow. Later tonight, the girl would sneak out to meet her friend Mina in the eye-watering public toilet, no doubt to cry over her mother's rejection of a dying neighbor. Asha wasn't supposed to know about those toilet tell-all sessions, but little happened in Anawadi that didn't get back to her eventually. Asha was pleased with Manju's obedience, her locally heralded beauty, and the college studies that brought strange names like Titania and Desdemona to the household. But Asha considered it a failure of her parenting that Manju was sentimental. The girl spent her afternoons teaching English to some of the poorest Anawadi children, a job that had been Asha's idea since it brought in 300 rupees a month. But now, Manju was always talking about this or that hungry child whose stepmother beat her. Asha grasped many of her own contradictions, among them that you could be proud of having spared your offspring hardship while also resenting them for having been spared. When food was short in Asha's childhood, the girls of the family went without. Although most people talked of hunger as a matter of the stomach, what Asha recalled was the taste. A foul thing that burrowed into your tongue and was sometimes still there when you swallowed, decades later. Manju looked at her mother with compassion, not comprehension, when Asha tried to describe it. As habitually as Asha sought a financial angle in her neighbor's complaints, so far most were merely tedious. For instance, the bickering between the Muslim breeder, Zerunisa Hussein, and Fatima the One Leg over whose small child had pinched whose. Asha didn't care for either woman. Fatima beat her children with her crutches, and Asha found Zerunisa intolerably smug. Just 3 years back, in a killing monsoon, the Husseins had no roof over their heads, at which time Rahul had perfected a wicked imitation of Zerunisa, weeping. But now she and her morose son Abdul were rumored to be making money.
Dirty Muslim money, haram ka pesa,
was how Asha put it. Her own aspirations centered on anti-poverty initiatives, not garbage. A government-sponsored women's self-help group looked somewhat promising, now that she knew how to game it. The program was supposed to encourage financially vulnerable women to pool their savings and make low-interest loans to one another in times of need. But Asha's self-help group preferred to lend the pooled money at high interest to poor women who they'd excluded from the collective. The old sewer cleaner who had brought her a sari, for instance. Still, when foreign journalists came to Mumbai to see whether self-help groups were empowering women, government officials sometimes took them to Asha. Her job was to gather random female neighbors to smile demurely while the officials went on about how their collective had lifted them from poverty. Manju would then be paraded in as Asha delivered the clinching line.
And now my girl will be a college graduate, not dependent on any man.
The foreign women always got emotional when she said this.
The big people think that because we are poor, we don't understand much, she said to her children.
Asha understood plenty. She was a chit in a national game of make-believe, in which many of India's old problems, poverty, disease, illiteracy, child labor, were being aggressively addressed. Meanwhile, the other old problems, corruption and exploitation of the weak by the less weak, continued with minimal interference. In the West, and among some in the Indian elite, this word, corruption, had purely negative connotations. It was seen as blocking India's modern global ambitions. But for the poor of a country where corruption thieved a great deal of opportunity, corruption was one of the genuine opportunities that remained. As Manju finished cooking, Asha flipped on her TV, which had been the first in Anawadi, though something had since gone wrong with the color. The newscaster was hot pink as he provided an update on the famous baby Lakshmi, a toddler born with 8 limbs and duly named after the multi-limbed Hindu goddess. A few months back, a crack team of Bangalore surgeons had undertaken her delimbing. The news story followed the usual script. The marvel of medical technology, the heroism of the surgeons, a video clip of the 2-year-old girl at home, supposedly happy and normal. But even on a bad TV screen, it was obvious that the girl was not fine. Asha thought that the family could have done better financially if they'd left Lakshmi alone and run her as a circus act. Still, it was the kind of medical transformation report that would get Mr. Kumble, who watched the same Marathi language channel, further riled up. Everyone in Annawadi wanted one of the life-changing miracles that were set to happen in the new India. They wanted to go from zero to hero, as the saying went, and they wanted to go there fast. Asha believed in new Indian miracles, but thought they happened only gradually, as incremental advantages over one's neighbors were parlayed into larger ones. Her long-term goal was to become not just slumlord, but the corporator of Ward 76, a dream made plausible by progressive, internationally acclaimed legislation. In an effort to ensure that women had a significant role in the governance of India, the political parties were required to put up only female candidates for certain elections. The last time Ward 76 had an all-female ballot, Corporator Subhash Savant had put up his housemaid. The maid had won, and he had kept running the ward. Asha thought that he might just pick her to run in the next all-female election, since his new maid was a deaf-mute, ideal for keeping his secrets, less so for campaigning. Ward 76 contained many slums larger than her own, but Asha had just made her first move to develop a reputation beyond Anawadi's boundaries. Investing in a large plastic banner with her name, color photo, and a list of her accomplishments as a representative of Shiv Sena's women's wing. The banner was now strung up at an open-air market half a mile away. Unfortunately, she'd had to include the photos of 3 other Shiv Sena women. The corporator had warned her more than once about hogging credit.
"But I had to pay the whole whack," she complained to her husband, who had appeared for dinner cheerful drunk instead of fighty drunk, a relieving change. "These other women, they still have the village mentality," she told him. "They don't understand that if you spend a little up front, you get more later."
Rahul and her youngest son, Ganesh, came in too.
Asha stood, laughing, to yank Rahul's cargo shorts up from his hips.
I know, it's the style, your style, American style, she said. All that, and it's still foolish.
They each took a plate of lentils, soggy vegetables, and lopsided wheat flour rotis, a meal whose tastelessness seemed intentional and perhaps the product of Manju's silent rage about Mr. Kumble. Asha knew her daughter judged her for her plots and side deals, and for the nighttime meetings with the corporator, policemen, and government bureaucrats that these schemes always seemed to entail. But the politics for which Manju had contempt had bought her a college education and might someday lift them all into the middle class.
So do I have to teach you all over again how to make the rotis round?
Asha teased her daughter, merrily holding one of them up.
Come on, who will marry you when you make such ridiculous bread?
The roti dangling in Asha's fingertips was such a forlorn specimen that even Manju had to laugh, and Asha decided, wrongly, that her daughter had forgotten Mr. Kumble. Chapter 3. Sunil. Abdul was always twitchy, but by February 2008, the scavengers saw he was more so, jingling coins in his pocket, shaking his legs as if preparing to sprint, chewing a wooden matchstick while his tongue did something weird behind his teeth. Across the city, gangs of young Maharashtrians had begun beating up migrants from the north, bayas as they were called, in hope of driving them out of the city and easing the scramble for jobs. Though Abdul had been born in Mumbai, the fact that his father had come from the north qualified the family as targets, and not abstractly. Rioters chanting, "Beat the bayas!" were moving through the airport slums, ransacking small North Indian businesses, torching the taxis of North Indian drivers, confiscating the wares that migrant hawkers displayed on blankets. These poor-against-poor riots were not spontaneous grassroots protests against the city's shortage of work. Riots seldom were in modern Mumbai. Rather, the anti-migrant campaign had been orchestrated in the Overcity by an aspiring politician, a nephew of the founder of Shiv Sena. The upstart nephew wanted to show voters that a new political party he had started disliked bayas like Abdul even more than Shiv Sena did. Abdul quit working and stayed inside to avoid the violence, about which roaming scavengers brought lurid reports. Ribs broken, heads stomped, two men on fire.
Enough! Abdul cried out one night. Can you please stop talking about it? The riots are just a show. A few bastards making noise and intimidating people.
Abdul was repeating the reassurances of his father, Karam, who sought to keep his children incurious about aspects of Indian life beyond their control. Though Karam and Zerunisa occasionally spoke in whispers of the city's 1992-1993 Hindu-Muslim riots and the 2002 Hindu-Muslim riots in the bordering state of Gujarat, they raised their children on a diet of patriotic songs about India, where tolerant citizens of 1,000 ethnicities, faiths, languages, and castes all got along. Better than the entire world is our Hindustan. We are its nightingales, and it our garden abode. This song, based on verses by the great Urdu poet Iqbal, played every time Karam's cell phone rang.
First, these children have to learn to run after bread and rice, he told his wife. When they're older, they can worry about the other things.
But Sunil Sharma, a perceptive 12-year-old scavenger, could read the frantic matchstick in Abdul's mouth. The garbage sorter was already worried. Sunil, a Hindu bayya, wondered about Abdul, who he thought worked harder than anyone else in Anawadi.
Keeps his head down night and day.
Sunil was startled once when he saw the garbage sorter's face in full sunlight. Except for the child eyes, black as keyholes, Abdul looked to him like a broken old man. Sunil was a seed of a boy, smaller even than Abdul, but he considered himself more sophisticated than the other scavengers. He was especially good for his age at discerning motives. It was a skill he had acquired during his on-and-off stays at the Handmaids of the Blessed Trinity Orphanage. Though Sunil was not an orphan, he understood that phrases like AIDS orphan and when I was the second-hand woman to Mother Teresa helped Sister Paulette, the nun who ran the handmaids of the Blessed Trinity Children's Home, get money from foreigners. He knew why he and the other children received ice cream only when newspaper photographers came to visit, and why food and clothing donated for the children was furtively resold outside the orphanage gate. Sunil rarely got angry when he discovered the secret reasons behind the ways people behaved. Having a sense of how the world operated, beyond its pretenses, seemed to him an armoring thing. And when Sister Paulette decided that boys over 11 years old were too much to handle, and Sunil was turned out onto the street, he tried to concentrate on what he had gained in her care. He'd learned how to read in the Marathi language as well as his native Hindi, and to count to 100 in English, how to find India on a map of the world, how to multiply, sort of, how nuns weren't as different from regular people as nuns were commonly said to be. His sister, Sunita, 2 years younger, didn't want to stay in the orphanage without him, so together they walked back to Annawadi, where their mother had died of TB long ago. Their father still rented a hut on Annawadi's stenchiest lane, where the feral pigs gorged on rotten hotel food. The house was 10 feet long, 6 feet wide, filthy, lightless, and crammed with firewood for cooking, and Sunil felt nearly as ashamed of it as he did of his father. When the man was drunk, he smelled like a stove. When not drunk, he did road work in order to smell like a stove again, rarely setting aside money for food. Sunil alone watched out for Sunita. Once, when he was 5 or 6, he'd lost her for a week, but he'd been careful not to misplace her after that. Losing Sunita was one of Sunil's few clear memories of early childhood. How upset Rahul's mother, Asha, had become. Suddenly, his ally, she'd tracked down Sunita halfway across the city, then barreled into his father's hut to say his children were going to die the way he was drinking. Not long after, Sunil and Sunita ran across Airport Road, each holding one of Asha's hands, as if they were any old family. When they reached the black iron gate of the orphanage, though, Asha had dropped their hands and left. In the years since, Sunil had come back to Annawadi frequently, whenever he had chickenpox or jaundice or some other goddess-in-the-body situation that threatened the health of Sister Paulette's other wards. He was therefore used to the transition, reaccustoming himself to scavenging work, to rats that emerged from the woodpile to bite him as he slept, and to a state of almost constant hunger. In the old days, Sunil and Sunita had stood silently outside the huts of their neighbors at dinner time. Sooner or later, some pitying woman would emerge with a plate. Sunita could still work this angle, but Sunil had now crossed an age line over which charity did not reliably extend. He looked closer to 9 years old than to 12, a fact that pained him on a masculine level, and might at least have been a practical help, but no one felt sorry for him anymore. He minded being unpitiable only at mealtime. At the orphanage, when rich white women visited, Sunil had refused to beg for rupees. Instead, he'd harbored the idea that one of the women might single him out, reward his dignified restraint. For years he had waited for this discriminating visitor to meet his eye. He planned to introduce himself as Sunny, a name a foreigner might like. Eventually, he'd come to realize the improbability of his hope and his general indistinction in the mass of need. But by then, the habit of not asking anyone for anything had become a part of who he was. In his first weeks back home, scavenging skills rusty, he took the sandals from the feet of his sleeping father and sold them to Abdul for food. He had consumed 5 vada pav by the time his father woke to thrash him. Another day, he'd sold his father's cooking pot. His own sandals he'd exchanged for rice, after which there was little left to sell. The hunger cramps could be treated by hits off discarded cigarettes. Lying down also helped. But nothing soothed his apprehension that the hunger was stunting his growth. Sunil had inherited his father's full lips, wide-set eyes, and the pelt of hair that swooshed up from his forehead. One distinction of his father was that his hair looked good even when his head was in a ditch. But Sunil feared he'd also inherited his father's puniness. A year earlier, at the orphanage, he'd stopped growing. He tried to believe that his body was just pausing, gathering strength in advance of some strenuous enlargement. but Sunita had since grown taller than he. To jumpstart his system, he saw he'd have to become a better scavenger. This entailed not dwelling on the obvious, that his profession could wreck a body in a very short time. Scrapes from dumpster diving pocked and became infected. Where skin broke, maggots got in. Lice colonized hair, gangrene inched up fingers, calves swelled into tree trunks, and Abdul and his younger brothers kept a running wager about which of the scavengers would be the next to die. Sunil had his own guess. The deranged guy who talked to the hotels and believed the Hyatt was trying to kill him.
"I think his guarantee is over," he told Abdul.
But Abdul said it would be a Tamil guy whose eyes had gone from yellow to orange, and Abdul turned out to be right. Like most scavengers, Sunil knew how he appeared to the people who frequented the airport. Shoeless, unclean, pathetic. By winter's end, he had defended against this imagined contempt by developing a rangy, loose-hipped stride for exclusive use on airport road. It was the walk of a boy on his way to school, taking his time, eating air. His trash sack was empty on his first leg of his daily route, so he could be tucked under his arm or worn over his shoulders like a superhero cape. When Sister Paulette passed by in her chauffeured white van, it could be draped over his head. Sister Paulette Toilet was how he thought of her now. He imagined her riding down airport road, looking for children more promising than he. On this road in the early morning, well-dressed young women hustled from the bus stop to their jobs inside the hotels, carrying handbags as big as household shrines. He hated meeting those purses on a crowded sidewalk. They could knock a kid into the street. But at dawn, the city felt roomy, enough for everyone. Instead of being pushed along by the pedestrian stream, he could poke around the gardens that the airport's new management had installed on the roadsides. He was an expert climber and intended to make use of the coconut trees when they fruited. He took care not to step on the emaciated junkies who nodded out behind the lilies. It interested him that from Airport Road, only the smoke plumes of Annawadi's cooking fires could now be seen. The airport people had erected tall, gleaming aluminum fences on the side of the slum that most drivers passed before turning into the international terminal. Drivers approaching the terminal from the other direction would see only a concrete wall covered with sunshine yellow advertisements. The ads were for Italianate floor tiles, and the corporate slogan ran the wall's length. Beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever. Sunil regularly walked atop the beautiful forever wall, surveying for trash, but Airport Road was unhelpfully clean. For waste pickers, the road where air cargo was loaded and unloaded was the most profitable and therefore competitive part of the airport. Crammed with trucks, truck bays, overflowing dumpsters, and small food joints, the place was every week more overrun by scavengers. Some of the men flashed knives to keep Sunil out of promising dumpsters. More often, they waited until he had filled his bag, then kicked his ass and stole it. Women from the Matang caste, traditional waste pickers, hurled stones. The Matangs worked in red and green saris, dowry jewels in their noses, and were nice to him back at Annawadi, where everyone waited in line to put their bags on a scale. But people of other castes were encroaching on the Matangs' historical livelihood, because steady work was hard to come by, and trash was always there. To the Matangs, people like Sunil, who belonged to an Uttar Pradesh carpenter caste, were invaders on Cargo Road. Worse for the Matangs, and for Sunil, was the increased professional competition for trash. An army of uniformed workers kept the environs of the international terminal free of rubbish. Big recycling concerns took most of the luxury hotel garbage. "A fortune beyond counting," as Abdul put it in a whisper. And on the streets, new municipal garbage trucks were rolling around as a civic campaign fronted by Bollywood heroines attempted to combat Mumbai's reputation as a dirty city. Stylish orange signs above dumpsters were commanding, "Clean up!" Some freelance scavengers worried that, soon, they would have no work at all. At the end of Sunil's brutal days, he sold to Abdul what hadn't been stolen from him. While the Matangs averaged 40 rupees a day, his take was rarely more than 15, about 33 U.S. cents. Sunil felt he would never grow unless he discovered scrounging places that other people hadn't thought of, and to that end, started paying less attention to the other scavengers and more attention to the people who threw things away. It was what Anawadi crows did, circling and observing before trying to seize. Rich travelers surely dropped fantastic garbage outside the international terminal, but airport security guards chased off the scavengers who came near it, even small ones who just wanted to hear if the signboard listing incoming flights went chaka-chaka-whirr when updated, as Anawadi old-timers insisted. The construction workers building the new terminal would also leave trash, but their site was enclosed by blue and white aluminum fencing, which provided no traction for climbing. The officers at the Sahar police station, which was located on airport grounds, would have a trash flow too, but like most people in Anawadi, Sunil was afraid of the police. He focused, instead, on a stand of yellow and black taxis next to the station. A food stall at the taxi stand served the drivers who awaited arrivals. Most of the drivers quaffed their plastic cups of tea, ate their samosas, and dropped their trash where they stood. This choice territory belonged to other scavengers. But Sunil noticed that not all of the drivers behaved the same. Some of the taxi men tossed their cups and bottles over a low stone wall behind the food stand. On the other side of the wall, 70 feet down, was the Mitti River, actually a concrete sluice where the river had been redirected as the airport enlarged. The drivers probably liked to imagine their garbage hitting the water and floating away, but Sunil had climbed the wall and discovered a narrow ledge on the other side, 5 feet down. By some trick of wind in the sluice, trash tossed over the wall tended to blow back and settle on this sliver of concrete. It was a space on which a small boy could balance. Of course, if he stumbled, jumping down, he'd be in the river. Sunil knew how to swim, having learned in Naupada, a slum next to the Intercontinental Hotel that went underwater each monsoon. He'd never heard of anyone drowning in Naupada, though. Naupada was the local definition of fun. The Mitti River, with its unnatural currents, was the place with the body count. After a few jumps, he trusted his feet. The ledge stretched 400 feet from the taxi stand to a traffic ramp, and people driving up the ramp sometimes slowed and pointed at him as he crouched there, high above the water. He liked the idea that the ledge work looked dramatic from a distance. In truth, it was less scary than working cargo road or scavenging during the riots, with the beat the bayas men running around. And he was willing to take risks in order not to be a runt and a stub. His sack grew bulky and awkward as he moved down the ledge, and he learned to concentrate only on the trash immediately in front of him, looking neither down nor ahead. By March, the riots over, their deepest effect began to surface in slums like Anawadi. Many North Indians had been afraid to work for 2 weeks. Unable to recover from the loss of wages, some migrants were belatedly fulfilling the hopes of the new political party, Maharashtra Navnirman Sena, which sought to uproot them from Mumbai. Abdul's parents rented a 45-square-foot room in the back of their hut to the extended family of a Hindu auto rickshaw driver from the northern state of Bihar. One afternoon in mid-March, the driver's distressed wife came to see Abdul's mother. Zerunisa took her 2-year-old son, Lalu, to her breast as she heard her tenant out. The woman's husband and his brother rented their auto rickshaw for 200 rupees a day. Although they hadn't worked during the riots, they'd still had to pay the rent on the 3-wheel taxi. Now they didn't have money to buy gas for it, nor the rent they owed the Husseins. The Bihari woman asked Zerunisa's forbearance.
"What can I do? Please don't chuck us out." "Ah, but the riots hurt us all," said Zerunisa. "Abdul had to stop working too. What do I hide from you? You know what the health of my children's father is like. We are 4 days away from sleeping on the footpath ourselves."
It was her habit to exaggerate her poverty to her neighbors, the scavengers, and the policemen who came for bribes.
"But your business will keep you going,"
the Bihari woman said, fiddling with the ends of the sheer green pallu that covered her head.
"Your house will not go away. You know the way we live. We earn to eat. You see my husband works hard, that my children are good."
Her middle son was the best student in the small school run by Asha's daughter, Manju. He knew an English word for every letter of the alphabet. Jog, kite, Lion, marigold, knight, owl, pot, queen, rose. Zerunisa tried to steer the conversation to politics.
Allah, those fucking Shiv Sena people, and whatever this new party is, for so many years they've tried to run us off. We work hard. Who is relying on their charity? Do they come to put food in our plates? All they do is create a useless tamasha.
The ends of the Bihari woman's pallu were now balled in her fists. She didn't want to talk about politics, especially with Zerunisa, who could run on like a train without brakes. She studied a lizard on the wall as it fanned out its throat. Finally, she interrupted her landlady.
What does your heart say? I won't complain about taking the children back to the village, looking like a fool in front of my people. At least I can grow food there. But my husband and his brother, what? To leave them on the pavement?
She searched Zerunisa's face until the Muslim woman looked away. It was as the scavengers always said of Abdul's mother. 10 men pulling couldn't get her purse out of her pocket. As tears filled the Bihari woman's eyes, Zerunisa cradled Lalu and began to sing to him. The scavengers said this, too. She wore that big spoiled baby like a shield. And so the Bihari men were on the pavement, and the wife and children were on the 3-day train ride back home.
She said listen to your heart, and I did, Zerunisa told Abdul a few days later. My heart said if we let the money go, how will we pay the next installment on this land in Versailles? What if your father goes back to hospital? Finally, we are making a little money, but once we start to think we are safe, we'll be stuck in Anawadi forever, swatting flies.
New people will come after the monsoon, Abdul told Sunil and the other scavengers, because that is what his father told him. Where else are they going to go? The city was rough on migrants, terrible sometimes, and also better than anywhere else. For decades, the airport on which Anawadi livelihoods depended was a realm of duct tape, convulsing toilets, and disorganization. Now, in the name of global competitiveness, the government had privatized the place. The new management consortium, led by an image-conscious conglomerate called GVK, was charged with building a beautiful, hyper-efficient new terminal, a piece of architecture that might impress on travelers Mumbai's rising status as a global city. The new management was also deputized to raise Anawadi and 30 other squatter settlements that had sprouted on vacant airport land. Though the airport slum clearance had been proposed and postponed for decades, GVK and the government seemed poised to get it done. Securing the airport perimeter was one reason to reclaim the land from the roughly 90,000 families squatting there. The value of the land was another, since the huts sprawled across space that could be developed vertically at enormous profit. The third reason, in an airport branded the New Gateway of India with a peacock feather logo, was national pride. For among the things that breakneck globalization had changed about India was its sensitivity about its slums. As big banks in America and Britain failed, restless capital was looking eastward. Singapore and Shanghai were thriving, but Mumbai had profited less handsomely. Though it too had an abundance of young, cheap, trainable labor, there were opportunity costs attached to the fact that the Indian financial capital was alternately known as Slumbai. Despite economic growth, more than half of Greater Mumbai citizenry lived in makeshift housing. And while some international businessmen descending into the Mumbai airport eyed the vistas of slums with disgust, and others regarded it with pity, few took the sight as evidence of a high-functioning, well-managed city. Anawadians understood that their settlement was widely perceived as a blight, and that their homes, like their work, were provisional. Still, they clung to this half-acre, which to them was 3 distinct places. Abdul and Rahul lived in Tamil Sainagar, the oldest and most salubrious section, which was anchored by the public toilets. Sunil's stretch of Anawadi, poorer and cruder, had been built by Dalits from rural Maharashtra. In the Indian caste system, the most artfully oppressive division of labor ever devised, Dalits, once termed untouchables, were at the bottom of the heap. Anawadi's Dalits had christened their slum lanes Gautam Nagar, after an 8-year-old boy who had died of pneumonia during one of the airport authorities' periodic demolitions. The third side of Anawadi was a cratered road at the slum's entrance where many scavengers lived. This side had no huts. Scavengers slept on top of their garbage bags to prevent other scavengers from stealing them.